Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm happy to be joined by a special guest today. Gromber Jeffers Jr. writes about politics for the Dallas Morning News, and at this point has a senior position in the Texas Press Corps, especially for such a young man. Gromber, thanks for being here. Really happy to see you.
Yeah, Jim, it happened so fast, man. I remember being here and there were so many, you know, other grizzled veterans, but you're right, you know. Yeah, I'm glad I started this when I was 8 years old.
There you go. I would never describe you as grizzled, but though I think we probably have some of the same people in mind.
Exactly.
at the time. Gromber, you had a great piece in the Dallas Morning News this week, and congratulations on it. The title says a lot. The headline, at least on the internet, is Democrats need a new attitude, message, and leaders, and they know it. And that's a packed headline, but then when you read it, there's actually a lot more than that in there that really comes out, I think, directly and by implication. So, you know, let's start with you telling us about what you kind of got out of the piece, what you were trying to convey, and then we'll kind of move into some of the implications of that.
Yeah, I mean, Jim, you know, parties lose elections all the time, of course, but this is one of those watershed elections where it really, really took the air out of Democrats, both nationally and locally. You know, sometimes it's not about losing, but how you lose and when you lose, and losing nationally to Donald Trump, and then taking the step back that they did in Texas with the Ted Cruz calling all races and actually making no gains in the legislature, actually taking up some small losses, that sort of hurt. And there's always just introspection and, you know, what do we need to do in terms of the party that lost? What do we need to do? How do we climb back? And what struck me is that, you know, Democrats, while they all say they need to change their message, appeal to average Americans more, you know, not be, you know, the party of coastal elites, they really don't have a consensus on how to get there. That's one thing. And the other thing is they don't know how on a national and on a state level to be the opposition party yet, to be the resistance. That sort of is proving difficult for them nationally and in Texas. And in Texas, you know, that's sort of significant because of what's going on in the legislature the past couple of cycles and how they share power now.
You know, I'm really struck in the article and in the way that the things you highlighted there by the degree to which the Democrats are at this moment where the manifestation of the lack of consensus you're talking about hides what feels to me like an even deeper problem. And what I mean by that is, on one hand, as you said, and there were good quotes in the article from prominent Democrats, this idea that Democrats have to move away and they're addressed, they describe this in various degrees of explicitness or covertness, from niche issues and elite intellectual interests, et cetera. And then there's a sense of, I think there's a quote in the piece of, you know, we need to go back to where we used to be, kind of our old issues. But I think that feels to me to be not the answer substantively. And it's not clear what the third way is, to use the phrase that's out there a lot. Generally, usually that's reserved for talking about Democrats and Republicans and polarization, but I think that problem exists within the Democratic Party too. I mean, that seems to be lurking in the piece.
Yeah, they're trapped in a sense, and they will concede this. They try to be a big tent party. Therein lies some of the problem, but they've kind of lost a sense of themselves. You know, what does it mean to be a Democrat anymore? I mean, can they really tell you? And you're right about looking to the past, the Clinton era. I think one of the Miguel Solis, the former school board member, Dallas mayoral candidate, talked about how Democrats were in this position in 92, in the run-up of the 92 election, after years of Reagan and then George H.W. Bush. And along comes Clinton sort of redefining what it meant to be a Democrat, at least in a great part of the party, right? Because there, at that time, there were still moderate Democrats, liberal Democrats, and conservative Democrats. But and he suggested going back to that model where you find out who you are and then, you know, be in the middle, so to speak. But this is a modern era in politics and kind of an era of Trump. And you really have to position yourself in different ways, reach voters in different ways, have different kinds of messaging. And it seems like Democrats are increasingly behind in that. And that's kind of surprising.
Yeah, I mean, I think as we kind of rummage around in here, what occurs to me is that the old fight is, there's still remnants of the unresolved perpetual fight in the Democratic Party between, you know, the centrist, the left of center, more right, centrist faction, and the progressive faction. But I don't think anybody has any idea what that middle is, and I'm not sure that that model of looking at the array of interests in the party is actually serving anybody anymore.
Yeah. And let me give you an example of the problem. I agree with you. What is the middle anymore, right? And I consider this, Jim, like they say they want to get away from the niche issues, the smaller issues, and really focus on kitchen table and what matters to most voters. But what does that look like? How do you do that? So what happens in the next election, Jim, when there are all kinds of Republican commercials on the transgender issue again and transgender athletes in women's sports? What does a Democratic Party candidate say in the primary and in the general election about that issue? Because they're going to be asked about it. And what will be the impact of it? I mean, can a Democrat dare say, take a position that that resembles a Republican on that issue and survive in the primary? I don't know. We don't know yet, right? But this is a problem for it. Just because you say let's focus on these issues doesn't mean you have to, you can't ignore the other issues. So how do they answer those questions and what kind of positions do they actually take? And that's going to be a problem for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the, you know, I think that's really, that really cuts to the core, particularly on the way that in the last cycle, the transgender issue was used against Democrats. I mean, without taking a position on the issue either way, you can still, and it's still playing out. I mean, Gavin Newsom tried yes, to retreat or reposition, put it this way, tried to reposition himself, and, you know, which was clearly read as a retreat by progressives. And that's not gone very well for him within the party in the short run.
No, and progressives will not allow you, and if they really believe in their stance on those issues, you can understand why. They will not allow you to retreat on those issues. And so you still have to run in a Democratic primary, party primary. And what happens? And not just the transgender issue, other issues as well. And so, you know, we'll see how that plays out. Of course, and this is, if Republicans used to have this problem as well and probably still do in some states, you know, they have to go through a primary process too, where if they're pushed too far to the right, then maybe they'll pay a price. Not so much in states like Texas anymore, but there's still some swing states where that's an issue. So Democrats have to think about that and as they figure things out. One other thing, Jim, remember in the 90s, in the Clinton era, Republicans responded with Newt Gingrich and the sort of the Contract for America and all of that. It was a stunt, right? But what are the Democrats all about? Why shouldn't they develop some sort of plan? Wouldn't that be a way to talk to voters? Right now, they seem to be on the defensive all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that points to a capacity problem with the Democrats, which I want to talk about. One more rev on this theme, though, is that I think part of the issue right now is that for all of the, you know, mainly Texas Democrats you talk to who are articulating a desire to reset or, you know, kind of recalibrate the party's messaging in some ways and their approach, you know, the energy in the party, and in this way, it's a little bit similar to the Republicans, is with the progressive wing.
Yes.
I mean, whatever you say about the numbers or where they are in line with public opinion on, you know, their issue set, that's where the energy is. I mean, you look at Jasmine Crockett in the U.S. House, you look at, you know, where the messaging is strongest and I think most consistent. It is the progressive wing, and that is putting some of these other more pragmatic spokespeople at a significant disadvantage, I think, because the progressive wing is better at doing the things you're talking about.
That's a great point. And if you remember in the 2020 election, 2016 also, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and the progressive wing drove the conversation in the Democratic Party about issues. Remember Medicare for all and universal free tuition and all of that,
yeah.
All the issues that came up driven by the progressive wing, you know, that doesn't happen in other sections of the party. It's just more of a status quo kind of thing.
So, when you stepped out of this or you stepped away from this, you know, you finished the copy, you hit send to your editor.
Yeah.
What were you thinking about what you really learned here? Because we've had conversations about a lot of this, and I think you really fleshed it out in the piece a lot. Yeah. I'm wondering if it moved your thinking forward much and in what ways. And the answer may have just confirmed what you knew, but I'm curious.
It confirmed what I knew, but it also... I also stepped back and thought about, is there a little bit of overreaction nationally to their predicament? Yeah, losing, it was a bad loss. But you can also point to Joe Biden and being stuck with Joe Biden and not being able to move off Joe Biden in time. And of course, the campaign that Kamala Harris one, we know now that it wasn't such a good campaign at the time. You know, beforehand, it looked like she was doing okay. But I think on a national level, and this is what I thought, on a national level, there's an opportunity with the midterms coming up, because historically, the party in power, loses, takes losses during the midterms. We'll see what Trump's performance is like. The margin in the House, U.S. House, is such where there are going to be 40 swing district races in the House. So Democrats can make gains in 2026. And so there may be a few adjustments needed, but their predicament is not as bad as, say, as Texas Democrats. And that was my immediate thought was, you know, on a national level, the pendulum may swing back a little quicker. There's a lot more work to do in Texas.
Yeah, I obviously, for obvious reasons, we want to move on to Texas. But, one last note on the national beat is that I think we're in a very difficult moment to read, to, you know, vastly understate the case.
Yeah.
What the impact of that, you know, how much the traditional expectations in national politics are going to hold. So as you're saying, you know, and I think very reasonably based on precedent, with 2026 the Democrats should be in a structurally advantageous position, given what we know about what that midterm looks like, is the out party, all of that people are familiar with. And yet at the same time, as we're recording today on Thursday morning, the Democrats are in a real difficult position in terms of shutdown politics yes. at the national level, which, you know, not to be the boy who cried wolf or anything, but really, you know, has the potential to scramble our expectations of that midterm election, given that somehow, and there's no somehow here, it's because Mike Johnson has been unusually effective with Trump's support at holding House Republicans together on this continuing resolution and on the budget. His ability to do that has inverted what we've seen in the past in budget and shutdown politics, where all of a sudden it seems as if the Democrats are going to be responsible for shutting down the government because of the politics in the Senate, again, because Johnson has been successful in the House, and because of the disruptive, this disruptive impact of the Musk-Doge effort where, you know, there's no winning solution here for the Democrats in the Senate from one perspective, which is if they hold the line, like a lot of the Democratic activists want to, and which one could make an argument for given the content of the budget, they're going to get the blame for shutting down the government, arguably. If they don't hold the line and they go along with it and say, hey, we weren't going to shut down the government, now you have to live with Republican politics. Well, the content of that resolution and the approach being implemented is going to put them at a significant disadvantage as this reshaping of the federal workforce, the regulatory model, all takes place. So all of that seems to me to have really scrambled the normal politics of that. And I'm wondering what the implications of that for 2026 are and our expectations of that.
You're absolutely right. And what it shows you, again, this the era of Trump politics for, at this point, for Republicans, they have the Democrats on the defensive most of the time. And when you look at this, it goes back to how to respond, how to resist Trump. And he has the ability to make it so that, you're right, they could get blamed for shutting down the government, which in their minds would be a reasonable option or a reasonable path to take. That's how you fight against this. But the reality is, you're right, it could be a bad decision, shutting down the government and their resistance to Doge. He's going to cast them, Trump and Republicans are going to cast them as being for the status quo, for bloated government and all of that. And so he's able to take a shield, and everything they throw at him, it just goes right back at him. And that's what they're going to have to figure out. And that's why I think it's essential for them to come up with a plan. Because if they make the argument, what should be the role of government? And nobody's really talking about this. They're talking about the impact of the cuts and all of that. But they haven't expressed, Democrats, what their view of the role of government should be. And that's hard to do, right? But if you're just on the defensive and if you're just responding to something that Trump did, and he takes you out of your comfort zone where you're now the party that's shutting down government and doing all of this, then you're right. It's going to reshape things. And the historical norms, right, Jim? Because we're seeing all the norms being changed or bent. With the party out of power having the advantage, it may flip.
Yeah, I think add another busted norm and pattern to the big pile that's sitting here that we're accumulating.
But Trump he's a problem for Democrats. He really is. I mean, on the surface, it looks like, yeah, we can run against this guy, all the felonies, all the background. And no, he's a problem for him.
You know, and I think that gets to something I hope to use as a transition to the state stuff. But it's something else that struck out to me in your piece is, and as I'm listening and, you know, listening to Democrats, and we're hearing a lot of the same refrain, which is, and this is, I'm going to be a little bit unfair here because there are other ideas, but there is this sustained through line as Democrats try to think about what they're doing in Texas and nationally as they attempt to respond to Trump is like, you know, we need to get a better message. We need to message more effectively. We need to get better at social media and podcasts. We need to do all these things in the way that we're doing outreach, but really underestimates that it, having a substantive answer to this that attracts people to your party and to your candidates. Yes, messaging is, of course, important, but what is feeding into the message is still very, it's unclear. You know, to your point about what does it mean to be a Democrat, you have to have a better sense of that before you can then go and start developing memes or writing messages or putting out memos. And I just think Trump has really made it difficult for Democrats to do that.
Yeah, without a doubt. He really has.
Now, that brings us to Texas to some degree. Okay, so as we talk about what the relationship between substance and message and political success and positioning and, you know, at the end of the day, political power circles, it brings us back to your earlier comparison that was made as an aside in the national discussion, but is important here is, yeah, Democrats nationally are in trouble. I mean, not as much trouble as Texas Democrats. You know, let's talk about where the Democrats are and let's travel the distance from the kind of big view that we've been talking about nationally to the main game in Texas politics at this moment, which is what's going on in the legislature. In other forums, and you've written about this, we've talked a bit about where the Democrats are in the legislature in the wake of the resolution of the fight over who was going to be Speaker of the House, in which the institutional power granted Democrats in the Texas House was a big, if not the biggest issue. Dustin Burroughs got elected with a minority of the Democratic caucus, substantial Democratic support that was crucial to his success. As we all, you know, as it was on the table at the time, it has become more apparent when we saw the House rules once the House got underway and the Speaker's fight was over, was that Democrats no longer had chairmanships, but they were granted vice chairmanships, some chairmanships and some subcommittees, and in a more transactional, mundane sense, those vice chairmanships came with funds and staffing. As we're watching the legislature unfold and things, as we were talking before we started recording, as things really heat up and we start getting to that point of the session where there's more velocity than you can keep up with, and the big issues are beginning to get aired out and to move through the committee system, you know, what do you think Democrats got out of this? Do you think it changes the balance of power significantly in the House to the Democrats' advantage?
No, I don't think it changes the power to their advantage. You have a personal advantage if you're a vice chair. You get, you know, staff money and all of that. It's kind of like a Washington model for the minority leader. But committee chairs are powerful, and Democratic committee chairs of yesteryear in the past enjoyed significant power. And that's gone now. You know, vice chair, I mean, the chair is where the game really is. So I don't think they're better off. And then when you look at the deal with Burroughs, there really doesn't seem to have been a concession on any issues either, which is very important because the Dems are in a fight on several issues facing the ledge this session. And it doesn't appear that they got any concessions from the Speaker on issues. So they lost chairmanships. It doesn't appear that they went to the Speaker and said, hey, we want satisfaction on this issue, whether it's vouchers or something else. And so when you strip it all away, it appears more and more now the fight really is inside the Republican caucus, and Democrats, you know, have parliamentarian procedures or moves to make, but Republicans can pass anything they want. And I think that's more true today than it was in previous sessions. especially since Republicans face outside pressures and a lieutenant governor in the Senate that are really pushing them to get in line with an agenda that is coveted by those to the right of, say, somebody like Abbott or some House members.
Well, it's good. It's interesting that you raise Abbott, because I was going to add to that is it also seems to me that part of what limits the potential of any gains that the Democrats might have gotten for this, from this deal, is that they made this deal with somebody that is now, though, shown much more alignment with the governor and the lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty hard trade-off.
Yeah. Long way from Joe Strauss, remember?
Oh, yeah.
That was a masterclass for Democrats in how to impact and use your power and impact state politics. Now, a different time, right? But they pretty much elected the speaker and were able to get some concessions out of him through the years. Now, Strauss wasn't the greatest of speakers for Democrats, but he was much, much, much better than what they've gotten after. So it's interesting that they really took a step back with this. And they had, you can argue that they had negotiating power, but then again, if the alternative was David Cook, the former Mansfield mayor, who got the most votes in the Republican caucus, maybe with Cook being the alternative, they didn't have a lot of places to go. But if I'm a Democrat, maybe I try to find a Republican that will cut a better deal than Burroughs did.
Well, it's interesting if you go back and think about the conversations we were having about this 6 months ago, say, more or less. I think it was reasonable at that time to say that Dade Phelan was probably about the best deal they were going to get. And once the Phelan candidacy became non-viable, it was almost inevitable that they were going to get less than. And as we've been talking about this, I've been wanting to stop and say, if I was a Democrat listening to this, I would probably be frustrated and say, you know, what the hell were we supposed to do? We basically got the best deal we can. So how about easing off on the fact that we're not getting much done? I mean, this is just a bald recognition of where we are at in the state and what the balance of power is like, particularly as the center of politics in the Republican Party has moved further to the right. There was no way that was going to be a better negotiating position for Democrats. They were bound to get less than.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, our conversation is more about the harsh reality than sort of an indictment on their political skills. It kind of is what it is. It's really interesting, though. I remember when Phelan first emerged and the activists were Republican activists were pushing him about Democratic Party chairs. And he was like, look, guys, name me one thing that we haven't gotten because a Democratic Party chair stopped it. One major thing. And in the room, they couldn't. And maybe some others could. But look, it didn't take long for the chair issue to become a driving issue in the ledge. And that's what's so fascinating, is that an issue that was on the fringe quickly became something that Republicans had to deal with. And it led to Democrats having to cut the deal that they cut. That and feeling sort of falling out of favor because of other issues, the move to impeach Ken Paxton and all of that, right? I mean, that all played a role in it. But you're right. The friction, the power struggle in Republican politics basically led to Democrats being in a more vulnerable and less powerful position.
I think another dimension of that I've become increasingly interested in, and I think I probably should have been more interested in it earlier, is the degree to which this discussion around the Democrats merged very usefully with the Burroughs opponents, the people that were most vocal about changing norms and practices in the House around Democratic chairs, among other things, right? The transparency and the operation of the House, the position and the power of the Speaker's office, the centralization, you know, centralization versus decentralization in the House, in that you have now a core of, and a big core of people in the Republican caucus who very straightforwardly and sincerely view themselves as reformers. Now, I don't want to seem gullible. I want to be naive about that. Everybody's self, you know, the Texas House, everybody, the legislature, everybody's self-interest is running around in here and active. But nonetheless, I've been really struck as I've talked to some of the Cook supporters in the House, some of whom are very new and some of whom have been around a while, who are very earnest in saying that one of the things they want is to reform the House, and that they think the House is, you know, could be run better and could be run in a better, if you want, if you will, more ethical, more effective way. I mean, you have, it's not just a talking point, I think, for some of these members, for example, to say that, why is the House always moving so slow? You and I have seen this, it's kabuki theater every session on one hand for members of the House, for members of the Senate to go, oh, the House is waiting too long, we're already moving, and the House is slow and they suck, and why, you know. The fact that now there are House members saying, we should change that. And that's not a rules change, that's a constitutional change, ultimately, in terms of changing the rules about how quickly you can move in the House. And I think in terms of talking about the Democrats, it puts the Democrats in yet another, a new world of bad positioning, in that the Democrats are seen as part of an old, creaky, corrupt order in cooperation with the power centers in the Republican Party that are being opposed by these self-styled reformers that do generally seem to be coalesced ideologically on the further right of the party. But that's also a very difficult thing for Democrats. They're now lumped in as part of this old, corrupt way of doing things that nobody wants to change.
Yeah, similar nationally to being lumped into, you know, not wanting change, not wanting a more efficient government and all of that. You're right. And notice that there were more Republicans really interested in being part of the reform movement, not so much Freedom Caucus or anything like that.
Yeah.
But when you said reform,
it's institutional.
Exactly. That was popular. And when you look at the Senate, now it's a different dynamic because Dan Patrick is Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor, but they move much quicker and they're much more efficient with the passage of bills. I mean, look at, it's just warp speed compared to what typically goes on in the ledge. And you're absolutely right about that. And the Speaker's race was much more than Burroughs versus Cook. It was about the way the House operates. And I think that's not going to end. There's still going to be fundamental change. And for Democrats, now there are some Democrats who make the point that, you know, being a party chair and the party out of power isn't that important. Because party chairs, they don't fight the same way they should fight if they're in the opposition party. And the congressional model is appealing to them because they're not beholden to the leadership. Now, what I say about that is the problem with that is that as bad as it may appear in Texas and alleged for a Democrat, local Democrats, there's still a level of bipartisanship where you can go and you can get, if you're in Dallas, if you represent Dallas, something for Southwestern Medical Center or some education initiative or something going on where you need funding in Dallas or Houston or wherever. You can still cut that deal if you're on appropriation or ways and means or commit or on some committee. you can still work with Republicans and get things. We don't write about that a lot, but that's still a reality in Texas. Not so much in Congress, but it's a reality in Texas.
Yeah, that intersection of representation and distributive politics is still there.
Exactly. And that's what you have to fight if you're a Democrat to preserve.
Right.
You don't want to be totally shut out.
And there's another interesting dimension to this, and we'll close out pretty quick here, but I was having a conversation with former Republican high-ranking staff member in the executive branch at a function the other night. We're having a high-level, well, it started as a low-level conversation about all this stuff, as these things often do.
Right.
But one of the things that this operative said to me really struck me, and it also made me feel, once again, like, why didn't I think about this earlier? And we were talking about the reform movement, the way that the party is operating in the legislature and in the state right now. And this operative made the point that it's interesting to see Republican elected officials arguing that the legislature should be able to do more and that the House should be moving faster. I mean, this argument that, you know, why are we lagging behind? Why aren't we more forceful and able to move and push things through? From a partisan point of view, this doesn't sound like a party of limited government anymore. This sounds like a party that is really aggressively and straightforwardly and not very covertly wanting to use government to their ends, setting aside whatever the ends are. And the reason it made me feel silly is because, you know, I dine out in my professor educational hat on reminding students that the legislature is designed not to do a lot. I mean, this is part of the Texas ethos, if you will, and the theory of the case of government. It's not an accident that these provisions are in the Constitution.
Yeah.
The underlying goal here is for government to be impeded, to not act very much. We know that, of course, government 101 at the national level, but it's even more true in Texas. And it's another sign that we're seeing that there is an underlying fundamental shift going on that is accompanying the Republicans' long incumbency in government and their response to what is going on around them. And it's fascinating to think about it in those terms, because then it speaks to this larger conversation about what we really mean by conservative. The idea of being a literal conservative institutionally has really changed in the state.
Yeah, I totally agree. And look, Texas is a big, huge, complex state. So there are things that you're going to have to do. But if you look at what they're passing, a lot of it isn't essential stuff, right? The session is 140 days for a reason. It's because it's designed to do what? Pass a budget. That's the only thing that they require to do via Constitution is to pass a balanced budget. After that, everything else, I wouldn't say is non-essential, but because it's just 140 days.
It's not required, though.
It's not required. But because it's just 140 days, you know, the idea is to get back to your ranches or your farms or wherever you're going, when you go home, whatever you do. And do only the things that the government needs. And you're right, that has gone out the window because not just the party in power, but as the state has grown and as politics has changed, these activists want more now. You know, they're looking at Fox or on social media and say, hey, why don't we have this kind of ordinance? They're at their local Republican meetings or activist meetings. And they're coming up with all these things that they need. 10 commandments in school is another issue. I mean, do you really need to pass that?
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's all these things that they want now that's on a wish list of everybody. And they have to use the session to pass those things. And I don't know that that's necessary.
Well, you know, I think to achieve those things, you requires something of a shift in the theory of government, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Because it used to be a very conservative talking point that we're going to do the budget. That's what we're supposed to do, you know, to the way you articulated it. And everything else should be thought very carefully about, and we should do as little extra stuff as possible. I think it was Democrats arguing for years that that was not, it was a more Democratic left of center argument to constantly be reminding people, Texas is bigger, it's more complex, we're an urban state, we're all, you know, we're bigger and more economically developed, government has to do more. Well, from a very different perspective, we're hearing that more from Republicans now.
Yeah, and the role of government from a Republican standpoint, it is changing. It's more like government can do these things as long as this comes from a conservative perspective. That's what it's beginning to seem like. But you can also go that route, Jim, with the local control thing. I mean, it used to be a Republican or conservative thing. Leave government alone, you know, state, Fed, local. That's changed as well.
Yeah, that's over, I would say.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I promised I'd let you get out of here, but I want to do a last hot minute on just sheer politics.
All right.
Give me your thoughts on Controller Glenn Hager being named the sole finalist for the A&M Chancellor gig. The line I rely on a lot for that is, if, as is expected, he is, you know, he ascends to that job or moves over to that job, he is then out of the field for 2026 and taps into a lot of pent-up demand among Republican elected officials and Republican political figures to move up in the world and to get into executive politics to move up in the executive branch. What are you making of all this quickly?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Republicans are getting restless. We haven't had a major shakeup since the 2014 election ushered in the Republican executive branch, most of what you see today. So they're raring to get going in terms of moving up in the shakeup and higher office. This is the first step toward that. I mean, Hagar is going into a really, really nice gig. Before this, he even wanted to move up to someplace, lieutenant governor or governor. That's not going to happen for him. But yeah, you already have a couple of candidates, Christy Craddock from the Railroad Commission, former state senator Don Huffines in Dallas, who was a candidate for governor last time. And there'll be more. You know, you hear some senators, we'll see what Senator Bittencourt out of Houston does. But this is the first step. And people want more. Republicans want more movement as well. And we'll see if Abbott and Patrick indeed does run for reelection. But I anticipate a crowded field for this, Jim, a crowded field. And a domino effect when people moving from the ledge or wherever they're moving from to vie for this office.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is one shoe that's dropped. The attorney general's, if you follow the attorney general on social media, the other shoe is untied and already kind of, the heel's already off the foot in terms of Attorney General Paxton challenging John Cornyn. So that's going to open up another very coveted spot in the AG's office. So once again, 2026 is going to be a wild one, I think, on both sides.
Yeah, it would be one to watch. All of the elections are fascinating, and they always say, this is the most consequential election in our lifetime, each one, right? But for Texas, 2026 will be very revealing, very revealing.
Whether it's a life changer or not, it's going to be busy.
Yes, that's good for us.
Grummer, thanks so much for being here. I'm sorry I kept you a little late, but
it's always good to be here, man.
It works like this. I love talking to you, and I really appreciate you taking the time. You take care.
All right, you too.
All right, thanks. As always, thanks to our guest, Grummer Jeffers Jr. Thanks to our excellent audio production team in the Development Studio in the College of Liberal Arts here at the University of Texas at Austin. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Should all go according to plan, it's spring break next week, but we'll have a couple of guests that we're lining up right now. So we'll have a podcast next week check on the Texas Politics Project website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. If you're not on our emailing list, join that. You can join that at the website as well, and we'll keep you updated on what's coming up, including polling, writing, and all of the other content we have at the Texas Politics Project website. So until then, thanks again for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.